first, we're going to go to the events in Northern Ireland, where it's been a seismic weekend for politics. Hilary Benn has been appointed new Northern Secretary, and by the new Labour Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Sinn Féin, just to remind you of the lineup of the seats, Sinn Féin retained its 7 Westminster seats. The DUP are down 3 seats on their 2019 tally. They now have 5, with Alliance, TUV and the UUP having 1 each. The SDLP also on 2 seats. We are joined first on the line, though, by Mark Simpson, who is BBC News correspondent. Mark, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colin.
What should we read from the appointment of Hilary Benn? Is this good news for Northern Ireland and indeed relations with Ireland?
I think it is. It's a reset, I think, we're going to see in relations between Dublin and Belfast, and also, I think, between London and Dublin. Hilary Benn, here in Belfast anyway, is liked by all the main parties. Let's see how long that lasts. Of course, as we know, there's a big difference between being a politician in opposition and in government. But, Colm, I'm reminded, and I'm old enough to remember, when Mo Molum landed here after the last Labour landslide back in 1990. Like Hilary Benn, she had been Shadow Secretary of State. She knew the politicians. She had their phone numbers. I think he's off to a good start being appointed to a job, a portfolio he knows very, very well indeed.
So what's in his in tray? What are the top items?
Well, the first one may seem a little trivial, and it's a sports stadium. It's Casement Park in Belfast, in West Belfast. As we know, the Irish government has pledged around €50 million to try and help get this GAA stadium built in the next couple of years. So it, like Germany at the moment, can stage matches in the Euros coming up in 2028. There's been a logjam. The Tories said they would contribute to the new stadium. In the end, they didn't. The stadium will not be built in time for the Euros unless Hilary Benn can dig deep into the Labour coffers and find some money. My understanding is that he is open to talking about it. It's doubtful whether the money will be found in time. But it's that old phrase in Belfast, roundtable talks. I think we're going to get talks with the GAA, the Irish Football Association up here, and the new Labour administration about whether or not they can rescue this project in the coming days. And it is days that we're talking.
Right. Will the Irish government perhaps be expected to dig a little deeper in order to invest in relations with the new British government, put its money where its mouth is in the form of Casement Park?
I think that's a good idea, whether or not it's viable or not. I think it would involve all sides having to dig a little deeper, including the GAA, who have pledged around £15 million sterling at the moment, the Stormont Executive, which is pledging around £62.5 million sterling. Between them, all of the stakeholders are going to try and have to find another £200 million sterling. It's a big ask.
The Legacies Bill, that's the Legacies Act, should I say, is also on the in tray, something with far wider implications, and something for which, if he wants to back scrapping it, he'll have large support in Northern Ireland, cross-party support.
Absolutely. But the question will then be to Prime Minister Starmer, to Secretary of State Hilary Benn, what are you going to replace it with? At the moment, we have this new process, which, as you say, has very little, if not no, support here in Northern Ireland. But the question for the new Labour administration is, we haven't dealt with the past here in Northern Ireland. What are you going to replace it with? And I suppose you could say it's a bit like the big picture with this new Labour government. We've got lots of vague ideas about what their policy is going to be, but I think it's now time for some specifics.
Just on, I suppose, the stability of Stormont, keeping Stormont up and running will be a core priority. What are the prospects for that, in your estimation, following the election results?
Well, in some ways, the election results don't change much in terms of the balance between unionism and nationalism. It's where we were before. Yes, the DUP have lost 3 seats, but 2 of them were taken by other unionists. Yes, they lost 1 to the Alliance Party, but the overall balance between unionism and nationalism hasn't changed that much. The big change is, it seems, Colin, the end of Paisleyism. I'm sure you'll maybe talk about that later in the programme. But one thing which I should mention about this new Labour administration that they can bring to the party is Sue Gray. You may remember she was the senior civil servant that investigated Partygate at Downing Street. She then joined the Labour Party. She left government. She's a former senior civil servant here in Northern Ireland.
And a former New Republican.
That's what I was about to say. She knows this island, north and south. She knows the border very well. She used to look out of it from her pub, as you say, which looked over the border down there in Newry. She knows Anglo-Irish relations. She knows Stormont better than anyone. And she may be part of the glue that helps to hold this place together over what could be a couple of tricky months, because Stormont's been hiding behind this election for a while. It hasn't made many, if any, big decisions. It's decision time here at Stormont. A lot of things need to change. And Sinn Féin, the DUP, the Ulster Unionist Party and the Alliance all have to make decisions soon, including about public spending. That's an issue which, election or no election, Labour or no Labour government, hasn't gone away.
All right, Mark Simpson, BBC News correspondent. Thanks very much for joining us. We're also joined on the line by Ben Lowry, editor of the Belfast Newsletter. Ben, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
As the DUP considers the results of the recent Westminster elections, what answers do you think it'll come up with for where its future lies?
Well, my goodness. So just to build on something Mark was saying, this was a disastrous election for the DUP. And at first, I think unionists thought it was a disastrous election for unionism. As the sort of things cleared and the votes were tallied, unionism actually pulled 3% ahead of nationalism. Now, while I cite that as the editor of a unionist paper, people might think it's a petty point. But it's a really important point, because my goodness, how unionists are taunted by Republicans about the inevitability of an All-Ireland. We never hear the end of it. We heard Conor Murphy of Sinn Féin lecturing unionists yesterday on how they must have a vote in the constitutional future. So while unionism is vote is well down in where it was 10 or 20 years ago, it nonetheless has pulled ahead, and it wasn't what nationalists were hoping for. But the question that you asked was about the DUP. And I think what happened to the DUP was this. Essentially, voters, unionist voters, gave them a kicking and went to other unionist parties. An awful lot of them went to the Ulster Unionists. That was a sort of almost humiliating defeat for the DUP in the unionist stronghold of South Antrim. That was an extraordinary defeat of the UUP in North Antrim. And remember, in one of those constituencies, unionists went to a very hardline unionist to unseat the DUP. And in the other, they went to a very moderate unionist to unseat the DUP. Now, one way of looking at this is, you will be familiar in the Republic of Ireland, as voters in the rest of the UK are, with occasionally voters giving a party a kicking. It's what happens. It generally didn't happen in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, because during the Troubles, I think voters felt there was too much at stake. They didn't want to risk. And I think in Northern Ireland that's still the case, because we still have.
And it normally happens. Would you concede, Ben, that it normally happens in what would be regarded as second order elections? Elections in the local and Europeans,
yes.
Back in the day, for a Westminster election, for people of a unionist mindset, this is the most important election, and to give a party a kicking at this point comes from a really profound place of discontent. So when the DUP looks at itself losing votes to the Ulster Unionists, also to the Alliance and to traditional unionist voice, what is the question it feels it has been asked,
and really
what is
good,
the answer?
Yes. And the short answer is, it's very hard to know what the DUP will do, because it's a real problem for unionism. Unionism has this three-way split. Unionism doesn't, whatever I'm saying about the unionist vote having edged back up again, it doesn't have the numbers, as nationalism wouldn't have the numbers, for a three-way split. I think a logical split for unionism is a two-way split. I think it's logical for unionism to have a liberal and moderate party and a more emphatic and robust party, the latter being sceptical about Stormont, the former being very pro-Stormont. That's a logical split. But how you get out of a three-way split into a two-way split is not straightforward.
Well,
first of all, the TUV and...
Could I ask you then how they ever got into this three-way split in the first place? The TUV is effectively a splinter group of the DUP. If you reel it back, I think about 12 years ago, Peter Robinson invoked unionist leader Edward Carson. Yeah. He was laying out his views on what he called peacetime unionism's need to increase its cross-community appeal and make itself, you know, a sustainable and broader church in unionism, because he was trying to effectively future-proof his own party. Yeah. It doesn't seem that people listen to him. People seem to have been more attracted to the siren song of Boris Johnson than they were perhaps to the longer-term views of Peter Robinson.
So you have packed a lot into that question. The first thing I'd say, and the implication of the latter point about Boris Johnson, is I happen to think, as a unionist, and I wrote this at the time, that embracing Brexit was a mistake. And I don't think unionism, again, had the numbers to survive Brexit. And, you know, it hasn't actually led to a big increase in support, in fact, much support at all for an All-Ireland, but it's definitely made things more difficult for unionists. That's the first point. First answer to your latter point. In response to how we got here, how we get out of here, why this has happened, well, I think one difficulty for the DUP is akin to a difficulty that actually Sinn Féin has suffered from its recent elections, which is when you are a party of, you know, quite sort of ideological purity, and then you want to be a party of government like Sinn Féin in the Republic, or are a party in government like the DUP in government here and Sinn Féin in government, you have to become much more pragmatic. And that's led to difficulties for Sinn Féin in things like immigration, and it's led to real difficulties for the DUP. So the DUP was the Peter Robinson that you're citing. It was this party that was trying to say, well, it's not like the old, they never actually formally renounced Ian Paisley, and they have huge admiration for the late Ian Paisley, I should say, but they moved very, very clearly away from that. And what that meant is that the TUV element to which you're referring, and other unionists who are not just TUV, who aren't a religious fundamentalist, saying, wait a minute, there's an Irish sea border. This is a constitutional disaster. It's the worst setback in 100 years, and we can't pretend it hasn't happened. At the same time, as in the Republic of Ireland, as in all Western societies, there's been a sweep away from traditional religious outlooks and moderate and same-sex relations and that kind of thing. And that has happened in unionism too. So you have this people have written off the Ulster Unionist Party, which is the most moderate of the three parties. In fact, it's had some really good results. Right. So how we got into a three-way split. How unionism gets out of a three-way split isn't straightforward. But I do think when unionism is in difficulty, it does start to be more sensible. And I think that it will. I think that in many respects, this is good. I actually think the Alliance Party, and again, its rise is cited, and Sinn Féin stood aside to try to help, but its rise is cited again and again and again as part of the rolling your eyes at stupid unionists who can't see where things are going. Well, actually, in the east of Northern Ireland, I speak to you from East Belfast. I was at a polling station on polling day. I grew up in North Down. I know it very well. A lot of people who were voting Alliance are actually saying, well, if you're going to get very involved in all these All-Ireland Republican events, and if you're going to be really extreme on sort of trans and woke issues, we're not sure we are so pro-Alliance. And they fell right back a little bit, but they fell back a little bit in those two seats. It's a complicated picture.
Okay, we are at a time, and that it should be pointed out, Naomi Long, of course, chose not to attend the Ireland's future event, notwithstanding the concerns raised there by Ben Lowry. Ben Lowry, editor of the Belfast Newsletter. Thanks very much for joining us on the line. Now, I'll reintroduce to the panel here. We haven't heard from them yet. Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin, Cian O'Callaghan, Social Democrat TD, and Lisa Chambers, Fianna Fáil Senator. To you first, Lisa Chambers, the results of the election, Ben Lowry didn't have, I suppose, an immediate or quick answer as to where the DUP will go from here, but there's a very real chance that some of the message they'll have taken from the electorate is that going back to Stormont was a mistake. Would the Irish government, do you think, be concerned that there's instability on the horizon if that is the message that's taken from the election results?
I think it'll take some time maybe to reflect on those results and what has happened. I think it is significant that in a Westminster election that the DUP have dropped three seats. That's a significant blow for them. So it is a very bad election. But their vote was split. And as was pointed out, I think it might have been Mark or was it Ben that said, you know, that the unionism vote held, but just split across three parties. So there's always an element of instability. I think we are still dealing with the consequences of Brexit, the topic that nobody wanted to talk about.
You have a sympathy with three-way splits when it comes to elections, do you?
Well, do we want to go there? maybe a certain level of experience, I suppose. But, you know, I think that we're probably still dealing with the fallout of Brexit, even though it was the topic nobody wanted to discuss in these elections. And the public voters gave their response to that at the ballot box, which is where they do that. And I think in Northern Ireland, we've had a lot of instability, you know, following the 2016 referendum, even running up to that. And we're still grappling with that. But I do hope that overall, you know, looking at a Labour government coming in, seeing Hilary Benn appointed as Northern Ireland Secretary, that, you know, finally we have some adults in the room. That mean we can have a good relationship between the UK and Irish government and try and get things back on track, because it's been a difficult number of years. It's been a decade really of instability between both countries. And I think we're looking forward now to a period where it's a little bit boring in a good way.
Right. Lynn Boylan, I suppose, contrary to what Ben Lowry was saying, the issue of unity, it's priced in when people vote for Sinn Féin. But it wasn't a prominent, I suppose, issue that was put on the table in the course of this election campaign, the idea of a border poll or anything else. It was regarded as a far lower key campaign, perhaps even a quiet campaign. And a number of the people we were talking to in Belfast on Thursday night said the fact that the border poll wasn't being talked about, they saw that as quite significant.
No, I think that you have to remember that the party is an All-Ireland party, so we were fighting two elections for the bulk of that.
A better election, it has to be said, in the Westminster elections.
Well, we've made gains in both elections. Or we've made gains in terms of our vote share in the north, and we made gains in the south in terms of, you know, we've two MEPs and we've increased the number of local authorities, not as much as we would have liked, but we made gains. And I think, you know, when you listen to Ben, like, the reality is that... as Lisa also said, is Brexit is a factor in terms of the DUP vote, because the DUP held the balance of power for a period of time. They campaigned for Brexit. I mean, they'd put the interests, I suppose, of Brexit and that ideological focus as opposed to the interests of the people of the north of the island, and knowing that Brexit would be a disaster for people who lived there, they went out and championed it. And then when they had a position to actually, I suppose, deliver for the people of the north in terms of the austerity of the Tories, they didn't. Again, they just focused on a very sort of fundamental ideological position of Ulster says no. And I think what you've seen in this election is that the people of the north of Ireland are fed up of Ulster says no. They want politicians who are going to deliver for them. They want politicians who are progressive, who are positive, who are looking for
You might
for
say
investment
that, although,
in,
you know, they did elect Jim Allister of Traditional Unionist Voice. The agreed candidate in North Down, Alex Easton, was supported by both the DUP and the TUV. The DUP still have four MPs as well. So, you know, in terms of what would be regarded as the harder edge of unionism, it did pretty well in this election.
Well, the harder edge, I suppose, that's where you've got the unionism is fractured. Do you know what I mean? So you do have a hard line position in terms of the TUV, but you've also seen the Alliance take a seat from them. So the moderate unionism have shifted away from that. And as I said, those who want to see the north, you know, work for people. There's, you know, real issues around public services. Casement Park is a big issue. It would be fantastic for the north to get that delivered. The Legacy Act, the, you know, all of those issues that really matter to people on a day-to-day basis, they've gone for politicians who've been talking about those issues and who want to fight and campaign for them.
All right.
And so I think that's a positive thing, that people have gone for positivity and not the negativity of the DUP.
All right. Cian O'Callaghan, do you think that the Irish government, specifically on the Casement Park issue, do you think the Irish government should take the view that maybe more generosity might be required to get that off the ground as an investment in this reset that's been talked about between the UK government and the Irish government, and indeed investing in, I suppose, community relations in the north as well?
I think for projects to work to build community relations between north and south and east and west, that involves everyone being involved. So it can't be a case of the Irish government simply contributing if the UK government isn't willing to do that. Look, it is a fresh start there with the change of government in the UK. It is very positive overall, I think, for Ireland in terms of the relationship that we're going to have. It is going to bring in a period of stability. I think the disappointment, really, in a lot of ways, if you go back to the start of the election campaign, is we could have been, you know, the assumption I think a lot of people had was that we could be looking at a period of, you know, 10 plus years of a maybe much more stable government in the UK. These elections haven't transpired that way. Really, what happened, we had a landslide for Labour in terms of seats, but we didn't have a landslide for Labour in terms of percentage share of vote. Really, the Tory vote collapsed. The Tories split their vote between them and Reform. And the Labour vote in percentage terms only went up marginally on 2019. It's well below their percentage vote in 2017. And in fact, less people actually voted for Labour in this election than in the 2019 election, with turnout being down. So I'm saying that because, you know, the hope of 10 years maybe of stable relations with a different UK government. Hopefully that will happen, but the kind of hearts and minds that Keir Starmer needs to win in this election to provide that kind of long-term stability, that hasn't happened. We've got quite a fractured political system in the UK at a level that we've actually never seen before.
Speaking of Keir Starmer trying to win hearts and minds, he's giving his first news conference in Downing Street at the moment. We're going to just hear a little bit of that. He was been fielding questions from journalists. He was asked quickly how the country can expect to see the change that Labour has promised. Here's what he had to say.
Look, the thing that's changed already is the mindset of government. It's a mindset of service, of country first, party second. That's not a slogan. That is the test for all of our decisions. So when submissions come to me from the Cabinet, when I've had to take decisions, which I've already had to, of course, the principle is country first, party second, and that's the driving principle. So that change has already happened. I set out before the election what our first steps will be. We've started work on those first steps. You've seen where Streeting made clear the steps he's already taking to resolve some of the issues that have been unresolved for some time, with a degree of raw honesty as well as to the state of being. So that's the mandate. That's how we go forward.
And that was Keir Starmer there at that news conference. We'll come back to our panel in a moment, but we are joined on the line now by Rory Montgomery, who's a former deputy head of the Department of Foreign Affairs, who led on Brexit. Rory Montgomery, the bunting outside of Downing Street today was with plenty of St. George's crosses on it. They weren't necessarily Union Jacks. It's going to be a heavy English focus for this next government. So where is the Irish government going to be able to winkle its way in and get the attention of the new government?
Well, I think already Keir Starmer himself personally knows quite a bit about Ireland, North and South, from his time as Brexit spokesman, also as a legal advisor to the PSNI, and he has a number of people with very strong Irish connections, even Irish-born, among his staff. I think the Irish government, however, you know, will use every diplomatic tool to build on what are already very good relations with the Labour Party. We're fortunate that in Hilary Benn, there's a really substantial politician, man of 25 years experience in Parliament.
Have you met him?
Twice a cabinet member in the Blair and Brown governments. However, I mean, I think the problem is in a way that I don't see necessarily a huge substantive agenda in the coming period. I think it'll be more about mood music, because in a way we both have an interest in keeping Stormont in place and developing the agreement. The one issue, I suppose, which we'll be watching very carefully is legacy, and I think clearly, you know, they've committed to repealing the legacy bill, but finding another way forward other than sort of piecemeal through individual cases might be difficult. And then, of course, there's the question of the UK and the EU, and while efforts will be made to improve relations there, and we will undoubtedly try to act insofar as we can as a bridge between Brussels and London, you know, I don't think it'll be that easy for there to be a serious improvement in relations there.
But on the specific issue in terms of what Ireland can help the UK to do and where there might also be a benefit for Ireland, an improvement in, I suppose, the mutual recognition of food standards, a sanitary and phytosanitary deal, which might help the trade between the United Kingdom and the European Union, and also help ease the issue of the Irish sea border in Northern Ireland. Would that be high on the agenda?
Yeah, I think it's top of the agenda. It's one of three specifics that Starmer and Labour identified in their manifesto. And so clearly, you know, that would make a big difference. Also, it has to be said that the British have not so far really fully implemented on their side the various checks required by the agreement, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. And so I think Irish exporters have not yet maybe felt the full brunt of this. So that would be really positive. But just to say, I mean, for this to happen, the Labour government would almost certainly have to accept what's called dynamic alignment. In other words, if the EU rules change, British rules have to change in step. And secondly, there will almost certainly be some role for the European Court in overseeing disputes. So not entirely straightforward, I think.
Right. And when Keir Starmer said that, you know, the UK wouldn't be rejoining the EU in his lifetime, he was obviously hoping to keep on board those Labour voters, previously Labour voters in the Red Wall, who briefly defected to the Tories over the issue of getting Brexit done. Could you see him signing up for that?
I think he probably could. I think if it's confined to something very tangible and specific like food, or even indeed, you know, chemicals regulation or a number of other industrial issues. But overall, yes, his red line's been spelled out very clearly. I cannot imagine that he will cross them in the next 5 years as a minimum, whatever about during his lifetime. But another problem in all of this is that the EU's focus will be very firmly elsewhere. I don't think there's any sign that the EU really wants to get into a major renegotiation with the UK. It'll have its own ongoing questions, the installation of a new Commission president, etc., Ukraine, economic growth. And of course, you know, there are potentially major, major problems within France and to a lesser extent within Germany, which will, I think, be a focus of a huge amount of political attention. And one point
maybe that's where Ireland could help, is it?
Well, it's not so much that. I think it's more that the French and France and Germany are the two countries the UK looks at and compares to itself. And to the extent that the EU is seen to be in a degree of turmoil, that obviously makes the development of relations with the UK seem a bit less attractive or urgent for the UK. The same thing happened with the Eurozone crisis and the migration crisis. But I think Ireland can be a sensible voice, as in fairness we were throughout the previous negotiations. While our focus was overwhelmingly on the Irish border and so on, we did urge the Commission to be as pragmatic as possible. And I imagine that if it comes down to specific negotiations on specific issues, we will be very positive, as we were indeed during David Cameron's period as Prime Minister, when he was trying to renegotiate a deal with the EU. I remember meeting him in a lift on the night of the European Council, and he said, "Your man is playing a blinder," by which he referred to Enda Kenny. An interesting point. I mean, obviously, Simon Harris and Keir Starmer are completely different in terms of background.
Well, I was just going to ask you, and briefly on that before you go, because you've met Keir Starmer. Have you also met Hilary Benn? And if so, what are they like as personalities?
Well, first of all, Keir Starmer, I mean, I wouldn't say that I know him the best of officials. I mean, our ambassador in London, when he was Brexit spokesman, Adrian O'Neill, would know him very well. But I, funnily enough, I was the first Irish official to meet him in his new role. He came over just after he was appointed Brexit spokesman in the early autumn of 2016. And his advisors, I think, are a lot sharper now, because he was sent over on a day when the politicians were all down in their constituencies. So I met him one-on-one and for about an hour to explain our position. And what struck me was he was very much the barrister. He was very much in the sense that he was carefully assimilating a brief, knowing what were the important questions, but very much cautious. I mean, not engaging in the sort of anecdote and speculation you often get with politicians. Hilary Benn then, yeah, he was chair of the Brexit Select Committee. And I do remember him coming over on a number of occasions to Dublin with his committee. And also, of course, I would have accompanied Simon Coveney to a lot of meetings in London, including with Starmer and indeed at the time Jeremy Corbyn and Benn. And Benn is a very sensible, clever, and a real heavyweight politician,
right,
but careful as well. He was a very good chair of that committee in that even though he had his own clear views on Brexit, he had to bring together, as with any parliamentary committee, people from a wide spectrum. And he did so with a lot of care and tact. And I think that speaks well and positively about the prospects for his role as Secretary of State for Northern Ireland.
Okay, Rory Montgomery, thanks very much. Former Deputy Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Rory Montgomery, joining us there, who led on Brexit. Lisa Chambers, is there, I suppose, room for optimism there on the European front, and Ireland obviously as a member state and with a clear interest in better EU-UK relations? What role, what constructive role could the Irish government play in your estimation?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we've played a very constructive role since that vote took place in 2016. We've always looked to keep a very close relationship with our closest trading partner and our closest neighbour in the UK. So we recognised from the beginning that it's good for Ireland if UK-EU relationships are good and if there's a good trade agreement in place. So we will always work to make sure that is maintained, and that's good for the agri-food industry here, for farmers and for other trading sectors as well.
But getting it on the agenda sounds like a challenge, judging by what Rory Montgomery was saying.
Well, I think it's permanently on the agenda. It may not be high up the agenda, but it's a work in progress. Brexit has not gone away. As was pointed out, the UK have still to implement all of the requirements of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. And I think that's the thing we have to watch as well, as any potential divergence in terms of regulations and standards. And I think that we're less likely to have that with a Labour government. I think Keir Starmer will be sensible. He will want a close relationship. That doesn't mean that he's talking about rejoining the European Union. He's put that question to bed for a long time. Nobody wants to reopen that wound. But I think he will have as close a relationship as is possible. And it's all about how you frame that as well. And I think he'll be very sensible about it.
OK, Lynn Boylan, you're off to the European Parliament following your recent election. Electoral success. Is it something you could see yourself working on? And what, I suppose, constructive role could Irish MEPs in the European Parliament play on trying to improve UK-EU relations?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fairness, the Sinn Féin have always made the case to our political group out there, the left group, about the importance of Brexit, and they have recognised that and have facilitated staff to be working on the issue.
Are you rejoining that group?
And we're rejoining them. Yeah. That's already confirmed. But the other thing is, you have got the delegation group that's out there, which the British delegation, which meets with representatives from Westminster and members of the European Parliament. We've applied to be represented on that, either myself or Kathleen. And so they, in those positions where issues of trade, issues of all the regulations will be discussed with, you know, members of Westminster. So it is high up on the priority, certainly for Sinn Féin MEPs. We need other Irish MEPs to join those delegations and to be there and to work, I suppose, in the way that we did in terms of Brexit, where we did all pull together and had a unified message of, you know, we want the softest possible Brexit for the island of Ireland. But there's huge potential for MEPs to be working on that and working on it at a daily basis. But for us, as I said, our group has recognised the importance of that and have facilitated us to make sure that it's given the due attention that it requires.
All right. Kian O'Callaghan, what opportunities do you see for the Irish government to play a role here?
No, look, there's a great opportunity for the Irish government here to get a, you know, good relationship back in terms of working with the UK government on Brexit and having a much more, you know, rational approach to it. The bit that we don't know here is how Keir Starmer and his government is going to react under pressure from the Tories and Reform. And no, Reform only have a very small number of MPs, but the Tories now are going to have them on their heels. And, you know, I think the Tories shouldn't respond by you know, trying to meet Reform halfway or anything like that. But it's likely that they are, given the kind of MPs that have been returned.
Well, we hear that Jeremy Hunt has ruled himself out of the race, so it's unlikely they'll have a moderate leader.
No,
next.
They're not going to have a moderate leader, and they're not going to play a moderate role in this. And I think they're going to try and play a very chaotic and disruptive role. So the bit we don't know is how Keir Starmer is going to react to that. He's obviously got a huge majority of MPs in terms of seats. We know he's very cautious. But we don't know.
Your particular concern is that if the Tories press them hard on an issue like saying seeing a role for the European Court of Justice,
they will. So we don't know how. We don't really know how under pressure Keir Starmer is going to react to that. We know that he's got a very different viewpoint on it. We know that that's not his instincts, but he hasn't shown at this point. He hasn't shown real mettle. Maybe hasn't had the opportunity to either as well. So that's a big question when, because this is probably going to be one of the big attack points for the Tories and Reform. They're going to be trying to win back those kind of votes they lost in the north of England and elsewhere. So how Keir Starmer reacts to that, how he tries to, you know, maintain a broad church coalition, which is really the, you know, that's how Labour has success. The Tory vote split in two. The Labour vote largely remained intact, albeit with the Greens and Corbyn, some independents on the left taking some seats and votes from him. So how he reacts under that pressure, that's the bit that we don't know about.
All right. We're going to change subject after the break. Coming up after this, we're going to look at whether or not we'll be going to the polls before Christmas.
Saturday with Colm O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.